Wonderful. Welcome everyone to Taking Stock. It is November the 20th. Looking forward to having a great conversation today with Michael, who is a terrific online activist investor here on X and elsewhere. First off, just thanks, Michael, so much for taking the time to join us today.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that. And, I want to just first to welcome any new listeners, as always. That we are an ongoing weekly podcast just focusing on online advocacy efforts, specifically those that over at ydrs.org. You can, of course, check that out if interested. The idea here is to provide meaningful and free access educational resources for custody solutions and market development so that retail investors can have a more meaningful future rather than the difficult reality that they live in today with asynchronous information environment and limited access to be able to make meaningful decisions about their investment future. With all that said, Michael, you're someone who I've had some, we've talked before. I know we appeared on, you've a mainstay over at the PP show. I was there, I think just once, but we had a nice conversation there. And, you obviously engage a lot elsewhere online. So I'm curious if you wouldn't mind first, just how'd you get started with all this and become kind of the online presence that you are today?
It's kind of funny to even think of like myself as like this online presence because, my name actually from my profile, it's Mind and Emotion 7, which is what I originally was doing. So I was in medical school and kind of stumbled into some people had asked me some questions about, stumbling into like kind of a psychology theory that I kind of put together myself. And I was working on an app that would analyze text for personality traits using this kind of new theory. And so I'd saved up some money and, just like a few thousand dollars that I was going to start paying a programmer. And I just thought, hey, maybe I should let this work for me while I do some of the work on the back end. And so I opened up, I started looking at different stocks. Actually, who was it? Anyway, I started looking at some different stocks and I didn't know anything about the market. And I just saw that if you looked at like the S&P 500, which I'd heard that before, I didn't know what it was at the time. And, cause I mean, I'm mainly, my degree is in biochemistry and then I was in med school and have lots of other hobbies. Like finance was literally the last thing, like the two things I least wanted anything to do with was finance and politics. Just because I just thought there was so much corruption.
And, yeah. I can relate to that for sure. What time was this? Like 2022,
2023? Yeah. Yeah. It was probably about 2022. I think I know that it also circulated around, so I remember on my Venmo, like it just popped up that like they were selling, you could buy Bitcoin and whatnot. And so I was like, I don't really know much about crypto. I hadn't really been paying attention at all. And I was like, well, this must be like kind of like a, if they're adopting things, it'll be good. And so I ended up buying some Bitcoin at 20,000. And I bought some Bitcoin Cash at like $100 per token. And anyway, like they kept dropping and kept dropping. And the other thing I had in my portfolio was I think what got my attention was just noticing that there was some adoption. And I was like, I really don't know much about this crypto thing, so I don't want to put like a ton of money in there. I just figured like there was adoption and the few things I looked up, I saw that they were being adopted more and more. And so when I looked at like just the S&P 500, I just saw this kind of slope going up, I don't know, maybe like 8% slope or something that the market was just had been on the S&P 500 for like years, decades, probably 20, 30 years. Maybe longer. And then I just see like this bubble and I didn't even know at the time, anything about like what that really meant. And so I was like, that just doesn't look sustainable. I wouldn't want to like at that point, how do you know if it's going to go bigger? Or I didn't know why it was there. Now I know a lot more about why it's there and whatnot. But So I started looking at stocks just to see if I could find something where the bubble had already popped. And as I started going through them, I saw Intel that it seemed like it had already popped and come down, and it was at like $30 or something. And so I know quite a bit about Intel. I had gone to, like, I grew up near Intel, and I'd been to their campus. I have lots of friends who work there, and, you know, I knew that they had just came out with a desktop processor that just was going to beat AMD as far as how fast it was. And so I was like, you know, they have a good dividend. I think this is probably a good pick. And I bought it. It might have been like $33 when I bought it. And then right after, they announced the CHIPS Act. And I was like, wow, I hit the jackpot. Like $30 billion is going to go into Intel. And that's going to make their stock price go up really high. And then it just dropped off. It went all the way down to like $25 or $24. And I like called my friend who, you know, he has a degree in finance and now works in law and stuff. And I was like, what happened? And he's like, oh, well, blah, blah. And I was like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Like, they just got a bunch of free money and their stock price just went down. And so I just started doing some research because I was like, well, things don't really make sense. And, you know, same thing, I guess, with there's all this adoption happening in Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash and Ethereum. I actually had Ethereum at like, I think I bought it at like $700 a token. And then despite all this adoption, like they all started going down. And, you know, then I realized, like, started figuring out what factors could go into that. And it's like, oh, like, what is the price that most people bought in? And, you know, how in the profits are they already? And I was like, okay, well, I probably shouldn't be messing with this too much if I don't really know what all goes into this. And I also then kind of had some things come up and I started needing the money. So I ended up selling all the Bitcoin, Ethereum, and the Bitcoin Cash all at a small loss. So now to see, like, 2 years later, it's Bitcoin's at $100,000, and it's like, you know, so my thesis is right, but I didn't realize, like, one, how much money there was for the people who control the market to make, while it seemed like it was flat or all these other things, that there was lots of corruption happening and they were making money. Certain people have been making money this whole time. I mean, Citadel's been making money hand over fist this whole time, but the people that are invested, they're not. And so I started becoming more vocal about it. And I especially, you know, I wouldn't have at all been, you know, I guess involved in this kind of way, except for, Bed Bath & Beyond. I started doing research on Bed Bath & Beyond, and it was fascinating that so many people were excited about it. And I kept seeing it kind of pump. I wasn't really drawn into the idea of a short squeeze. Actually, I didn't really know what a short squeeze at that time was, but I didn't want to try to ride some like kind of hype cycle or whatever. But I couldn't get it off my radar. And so I started doing some research you know, then the price started going down quite drastically. And when it hit like 35 cents and the CEO came out and said what her plan was to fix the company, I started doing some calculations and I was like, you know, I think Bed Bath & Beyond's worth at least like $6 or $7. And, you know, if her plan works, I think this could work. And so I bought in. I actually bought in pretty heavily. And then they go early into bankruptcy. And I'm like, what just happened? And so I, you know, started connecting with other people to see if they, you know, knew what was going on. I started doing a lot of research, and, you know, that's when I had joined the PP show. Is I'm like, well, I originally joined just because I wanted to, someone found me. They liked the DD I wrote on Reddit about my $6 to $7 per share kind of analysis. And so then I came on the PP show just to share that. And then suddenly I was just on the PP show helping to read dockets from the chapter 11 And, you know, then I'm like seeing things that didn't appear in court. And I'm like, okay, why aren't they talking about, like, it seems like there was some massive fraud because a company that was handling what's called like the e-commerce solution for Bed Bath & Beyond was Blue Yonder. And, you know, Blue Yonder was also helping, or the same people that were with it were doing Wayfair. And I was like, well, during the pandemic, Wayfair made tons of money and somehow Bed Bath & Beyond didn't. And so why did that happen? And I started to learn more about Ryan Cohen, and he had a bunch of tweets about how bad Boston Consulting Group was. And so it wasn't too hard to see, oh, well, Blue Yonder is one of the main companies of Boston Consulting Group. And so I just started following each thread, and it was like this crazy adventure to see how everything is connected. And it led me from everything from, you know, JP Morgan to Jeffrey Epstein and to, you know, finding out that Boston Consulting Group is in every cabinet in every government in Europe, and that there's weird relationships between the clearinghouses that do all the trade settlements. And so it was like kind of overwhelming to just kind of pull at these strings. And I didn't have a background. I didn't really know much or anything about Jeffrey Epstein before. Like, it's kind of funny. I found all of this through literally a stock, like just Bed Bath & Beyond. Like, I had no idea who Ryan Cohen was. I had no idea who Jeffrey Epstein was. Like, and here I am like putting all these pieces together. Whereas like other people have been doing it for a long time. You know, you have like Whitney Webb and some other people that have been laying this out there. And it's kind of funny that I approached it all from Bed Bath & Beyond and ended up finding all how that's all connected, only to find that other people had already been ahead of me in like flushing out, you know, this criminal empire. But when I found that it was even bigger than just one stock, it was that this whole idea of stock lending, which is just a weird concept to begin with, that when you look into the people involved in this company called Equilend, that they're all connected, and they're all even connected through the market makers. And, you know, a friend of Jeffrey Epstein is a client of Doug Cifu from Virtu Financial. And that friend, you know, works for Enigma Securities, which does stock lending, but like, they're not a US company. And so it's like you can just see this game of shell companies and obfuscation and, you know, buying off regulators to, you know, it's so complicated that no one really had been looking behind the curtain to see what was really happening. And it's just been a weird adventure as I've been trying to kind of share what I've been finding and find other people that are doing the same. And it, you know, luckily I'm very optimistic about what's going on. Part of that I realized is DRS. And part of that is hopefully the whole system just has to move to a new system that will make DRS even more practical and usable. Just because there has to be accountability. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that we can number each dollar bill that gets printed, but we can't number each stock that gets issued and traded.
It's an absolutely fascinating rabbit hole. Is too small of a concept, right? Because it's maybe you stick your head in, but there's this giant cavern within. It's not just some simple little hole, but a massive interconnecting web. And I really appreciate your laying out your experience there, you know, starting from limited investments that you learn more about, and that graduating into more and more detailed, you know, things that you're learning. And I think the through line here is curiosity, right? That you're not content to take at surface value the, you know, following the CHIPS Act, the analysis is saying one thing, Wall Street, lit market pricing is saying something, and you're thinking that it doesn't quite make sense with your understanding of how things should work. And so you take that opportunity to dive in a bit deeper. And I think that's something that I want to commend not only you, but all of the online retail investment communities that have been cropping up in the last couple of years, you know, for that curiosity, for that tenacity, because it's only with these sorts of qualities that we'll ever be. Taking Stock. It is November the 20th. Looking forward to having a great conversation today with Michael, who is a terrific online activist investor on X and elsewhere. First off, just thanks, Michael, so much for taking the time to join us today.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that. And, I want to just first to welcome any new listeners, as always. You know, that we are an ongoing weekly podcast, just focusing on online advocacy efforts, specifically those that over at ydrs.org. You can, of course, check that out if interested. The idea here is to provide meaningful and free access educational resources for custody solutions and market development so that retail investors can have a more meaningful future rather than the difficult reality that they live in today with asynchronous information environment and limited access to be able to make meaningful decisions about their investment future. With all that said, Michael, you're someone who I've had some, we've talked before. I know we appeared on, you've a mainstay over at the PP show. I was there, I think just once, but we had a nice conversation there. And, you obviously engage a lot elsewhere online. So I'm curious if you wouldn't mind first, just how'd you get started with all this and become kind of the online presence that you are today?
It's kind of funny to even think of like me, myself as like this online presence because, my name actually from my profile, it's Mind and Emotion 7, which is what I originally was doing. So I was in medical school and kind of stumbled into some people had asked me some questions about, I ended up like stumbling into like kind of a psychology theory that I kind of put together myself. And I was working on an app that would analyze text for personality traits using this kind of new theory. And so I'd saved up some money and, just like a few thousand dollars that I was going to start paying a programmer. And I just thought, hey, maybe I should let this work for me while I do some of the work on the back end. And so I opened up, I started looking at different stocks. Actually, who was it? Anyway, I started looking at some different stocks and I didn't know anything about the market. And I just saw that if you looked at like the S&P 500, which I'd heard that before, I didn't know what it was at the time. And, I'm mainly, my degree is in biochemistry and then I was in med school and have lots of other hobbies. Like finance was literally the last thing. Like the two things I least wanted anything to do with was finance and politics. Just because I just thought there was so much corruption.
I can relate to that for sure. What time was this? Like 2022,
2023? Yeah. Yeah. It was probably about 2022. I think I know that it also circulated around, so I remember on my Venmo, like it just popped up that like they were selling, you could buy Bitcoin and whatnot. And so I was like, I don't really know much about crypto. I hadn't really been paying attention at all. And I was like, well, this must be like kind of like a, if they're adopting things, it'll be good. And so I ended up buying some Bitcoin at 20,000. And I bought some Bitcoin Cash at like, $100 per token. And, they kept dropping and kept dropping. And the other thing I had in my portfolio was I think what got my attention was just noticing that there was some adoption. And I was like, I really don't know much about this crypto thing. So I don't want to put like a ton of money in there. I just figured like there was adoption and the few things I looked up, I saw that that they're being adopted more and more. And so when I looked at like just the S&P 500, I just saw this kind of slope going up, you know, I don't know, maybe like 8% slope or something that the market was just had been on the S&P 500 for like years, decades, you know, probably 20, 30 years, maybe longer. And then I just see like this bubble. And I didn't even know at the time, you know, anything about like what that really meant. And so I was like, that just doesn't look sustainable. I wouldn't want to like at that point, how do you know if it's going to go bigger? Or I didn't know why it was there. Now I know a lot more about why it's there and whatnot. But so I started looking at stocks just to see if I could find something where the bubble had already popped. And as I started going through them, I saw Intel that it seemed like it had already popped and come down, and it was at like $30 or something. And so I know quite a bit about Intel. I had gone to like, I grew up near Intel and I'd been to their campus. I have lots of friends who work there, and you know, I knew that they had just came out with a desktop processor that just was going to beat AMD as far as how fast it was. And so I was like, you know, they have a good dividend. I think this is probably a good pick. And I bought it. It might have been like $33 when I bought it. And then right after they announced the CHIPS Act, and I was like, wow, I hit the jackpot. Like $30 billion is going to go into Intel. And that's going to make their stock price go up really high. And then it just dropped off. It went all the way down to like $25 or $24. And I like called my friend who, you know, he has a degree in finance and now works in law and stuff. And I was like, what happened? And he's like, oh, well, blah, blah. And I was like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Like they just got a bunch of free money and their stock price just went down. And so I just started doing some research because I was like, well, things don't really make sense. And you know, same thing, I guess, with there's all this adoption happening in Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash and Ethereum. I actually had Ethereum at like, I think I bought it at like $700 a token. And then despite all this adoption, like they all started going down. And, you know, then I realized like started figuring out what factors could go into that. And it's like, oh, like what is the price that most people bought in? And, you know, how in the profits are they already? And I was like, okay, well, I probably shouldn't be messing with this too much if I don't really know what all goes into this. And I also then kind of had some things come up and I started needing the money. So I ended up selling all the Bitcoin, Ethereum, and the Bitcoin Cash all at a small loss. So now to see like 2 years later, it's Bitcoin's at $100,000, and it's like, you know, so my thesis is right, but I didn't realize like one, how much money there was for the people who control the market to make, while it seemed like it was flat or all these other things, that there was lots of corruption happening and they were making money. Certain people have been making money this whole time. I mean, Citadel's been making money hand over fist this whole time, but the people that are invested, they're not. And so I started becoming more vocal about it, and I especially, you know, I wouldn't have at all been, you know, I guess involved in this kind of way except for Bed Bath & Beyond. I started doing research on Bed Bath & Beyond, and it was fascinating that so many people were excited about it, and I kept seeing it kind of pump. I wasn't really drawn into the idea of a short squeeze. Actually, I didn't really know what a short squeeze at that time was, but I didn't want to try to ride some like kind of hype cycle or whatever. But I couldn't get it off my radar. And so I started doing some research and then the price started going down quite drastically. And when it hit like 35 cents and the CEO came out and said what her plan was to fix the company, I started doing some calculations and I was like, you know, I think Bed Bath & Beyond's worth at least like $6 or $7. And, you know, if her plan works, I think this could work. And so I bought in, I actually bought in pretty heavily. And then they just, or they go early into bankruptcy, and I'm like, what just happened? And so I, you know, started connecting with other people to see if they, you know, knew what was going on. I started doing a lot of research, and, you know, that's when I had joined the PP show. Is I'm like, well, I originally joined just because I wanted to, someone found me. They liked the DD I wrote on Reddit about my $6 to $7 per share kind of analysis. And so then I came on the PP show just to share that. And then suddenly I was just on the PP show helping to read dockets from the chapter 11. And, you know, then I'm like seeing things that didn't appear in court. And I'm like, okay, why aren't they talking about, like, it seems like there was some massive fraud because a company that was handling what's called like the e-commerce solution for Bed Bath & Beyond was Blue Yonder. And, you know, Blue Yonder was also helping, or the same people that were with it were doing Wayfair. And I was like, well, during the pandemic, Wayfair made tons of money, and somehow Bed Bath & Beyond didn't. And so why did that happen? And I started to learn more about Ryan Cohen, and he had a bunch of tweets about how bad Boston Consulting Group was. And so it wasn't too hard to see, oh, well, Blue Yonder is one of the main companies of Boston Consulting Group. And so I just started following each thread, and it was like this crazy adventure to see how everything is connected. And it led me from everything from, you know, JP Morgan to Jeffrey Epstein, and to, you know, finding out that Boston Consulting Group is in every cabinet in every government in Europe. And that there's weird relationships between the clearinghouses that do all the trade settlements. And so it was like kind of overwhelming to just kind of pull at these strings. And I didn't have a background. I didn't really know much or anything about Jeffrey Epstein before. Like, it's kind of funny. I found all of this through literally a stock, like just Bed Bath & Beyond, like, I had no idea who Ryan Cohen was. I had no idea who Jeffrey Epstein was. Like, and here I am, like, putting all these pieces together, whereas like other people have been doing it for a long time. You know, you have like Whitney Webb and some other people that have been laying this out there. And it's kind of funny that I approached it all from Bed Bath & Beyond and ended up finding all how that's all connected, only to find that other people had already been ahead of me in like flushing out, you know, this criminal empire. But when I found that it was even bigger than just one stock, it was that this whole idea of stock lending, which is just a weird concept to begin with, that when you look into the people involved in this company called Equilend, that they're all connected, and they're all even connected through the market makers. And, you know, a friend of Jeffrey Epstein is a client of Doug Cifu from Virtu Financial. And that friend, you know, works for Enigma Securities, which does stock lending, but like they're not a U.S. company. And so it's like you can just see this game of shell companies and obfuscation and, you know, buying off regulators to, you know, it's so complicated that no one really had been looking behind the curtain to see what was really happening. And it's just been a weird adventure as I've been trying to kind of share what I've been finding and find other people that are doing the same. And it, you know, luckily I'm very optimistic about what's going on. Part of that I realized is DRS. And part of that is hopefully the whole system just has to move to a new system that will make DRS even more practical and usable, just because there has to be accountability. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that we can number each dollar bill that gets printed, but we can't number each stock that gets issued and traded.
It's an absolutely fascinating rabbit hole. Is too small of a concept, right? Because it's maybe you stick your head in, but there's this giant cavern within. It's not just some simple little hole, but a massive interconnecting web. And I really appreciate your laying out your experience there. You know, starting from limited investments that you learn more about, and that graduating into more and more detailed. Things that you're learning. And I think the through line here is curiosity, right? That you're not content to take at surface value the, following the CHIPS Act, the analysis is saying one thing, Wall Street, lit market pricing is saying something, and you're thinking that it doesn't quite make sense with your understanding of how things should work. And so you take that opportunity to dive in a bit deeper. And I think that's something that I want to commend not only you, but all of the online retail investment communities that have been cropping up in the last couple of years, for that curiosity, for that tenacity, because it's only with these sorts of qualities that we'll ever be able to collaboratively uncover these interconnecting webs of nebulous information that, as you say, I've found a similar thing coming at this from a custody perspective, thinking about DRS first, and how so many stocks are all affected by the same problems. Share lending just being one of those, but a huge one. And it's not that any specific security is beholden any more than any other in terms of the legal process, because there is sanctioned lending and abusive lending that does happen and is all right from the perspective of regulators. Every stock is vulnerable, but as you brought up with, BCG exposure existing on different boards, and they're not the only, consultation company that has this kind of alleged playbook. But at the end of the day, they are the decision makers for which companies these kinds of tools, potentially abusive tools, are levied against. And, the retail investor, folks like you and I and the listeners today, and in the future, we're the ones that are on the back foot, that we don't have access to any kind of distributed information or transparency. And we are left to piece these things together with breadcrumbs and again, with that ongoing tenacity. So I'm right there with you on a lot of what you brought up.
And we also don't have the context because, there's all these laws that were put in place after old crashes where people came together and demanded certain laws and regulations to be able to prevent, the corruption that happens. You have like the Glass-Steagall Act, right? Which separates out that and made a bank not be able to also sell insurance and settle, and sell securities. And that was important, right? And, they kind of have this playbook where they create like a crisis and then like, oh, we need to do this because like this merger needs to go through. Otherwise, it's going to take down the whole economy and, just trust us. And, it's interesting that one rule was that one bank wasn't allowed to have more than 10% depositors, the total deposits of the country. And, yet that same rule isn't applied to that one consulting agency isn't allowed to be part of more than 10% of the public companies. You have Boston Consulting Group, McKinsey, Bain Consulting in every single public company with their fingers deep inside it. They have all that insider information, and they even had their own hedge fund, right? All of them did. And they get a slap on the wrist when they totally abuse it. And then they're like, okay, we'll further separate these two. It's like, yeah, that's also what Bernie Madoff said. He was going to separate his market making group, company from his hedge fund. And he didn't, obviously. Like, there's just too much financial incentive. And I think that, people just don't see the value in trying to figure out how things should work. And because it's such a steep slope to figure out how they should work. And it's like we're kind of made to think, well, one, it's impossible, so don't try. And two, like, could you really think of a better system? And it's like, well, we have to do something because it's it's unsustainable, like absolutely unsustainable. And there's so many different ways to see it. But I mean, there were a lot of people that didn't know anything about the mortgage-backed security problem until literally the whole global economy ground to a halt in 2008. And I just don't think we have to wait till that happens to see what's going to cause it. There, you know, despite what anyone says, you know, you watch The Big Short and they make it seem like no one knew, just a few smart people saw it. No, there were academic papers in 2005 about the unsustainability. The people who invented mortgage-backed securities, literally, which was JP Morgan, they stopped selling them in like 2005 because they knew it was going to cause a problem. So they handed over, they created this weapon and then let all the other banks use it and get themselves in trouble. And what do you know? They got to buy those banks out for pennies on the dollar after they crashed. I think that it's just come to the fact that there's, you know, really only two sort of sides of things, the builders and the destroyers. And it's just so much easier to make money destroying things. Like, I think the best example, the clearest example is Washington Mutual. If you look at, you know, you can look at the trade volume and everything, the short interest, and that's just like reported, not counting any short sort of like total return swaps or anything. The amount of money that was made just through shorted shares, you know, shares sold and then repurchased later, there was $50 billion made on the downfall of Washington Mutual Bank. And you think about that, when would Washington Mutual ever have made $50 billion profit? You know, it's one thing for a company to make $50 billion in revenue, I mean, it's still a lot, but of actual profit. And it wouldn't happen, right? Especially if they're just giving loans, especially if, you know, there's just not that much money there. And so they just become these targets and they have these cycles where, you know, they hype it up and it's even easier once they can control people's retirement money and where that flows. And so you can see this whole scam starting where JP Morgan lobbies the government and the Federal Reserve to require a 401k. And that wasn't a thing. They used to do
very recent, or pension funds getting managed by the, you know, hedge funds.
Yeah, and it used to be that you just got an annuity, like the company just paid you what they promised they'd pay you, and you know they switched it to where it's like, oh, they require all these companies to give 401k or to match a 401k or require a 401k. And so everyone starts moving over and it seems like they're going to get the same benefit unless there's a crash, which there seems to be every few years. And the other thing is that the whole scam goes so deeply is that they get to use all those votes. So they get to know which companies are going to live and die because they can stack the board however they want. They can put someone, BlackRock can take all the votes. The shareholder votes for all these retirement funds that they shouldn't be in control of. They shouldn't be able to be in control of that many of them. And they can use all those to put someone like Mark Triton on the board of Bed Bath & Beyond and then proceed to sell off everything valuable. And then they have someone like Jim Cramer just pump it. Like he was apparently Mark Triton when he first got to Bed Bath & Beyond was on Mad Money like every week. And they just kept pumping it and pumping it and pumping it. Meanwhile, in the background, he's just gutting it and gutting it and gutting it. And then, I mean, they sold out all the properties. You know, they got into debt with all these bonds, bought all these properties. Then they sold $1 billion worth of properties for like $250 million, right? So they took a fat loss. And then they used that $250 million on share buybacks. It's the most insane thing that's ever happened. And yet no one blinked an eye. No news station was like, hey, that's really messed up. Like there's something we should look into. Just no one said it.
I think there's two halves to that, right? First being that it's not altogether uncommon for companies to act in this way. You know, share buybacks are something that was illegal just, you know, a few scant decades ago. And now are quite common year by year for a ton of public companies. And second being that there's, you know, a, private industry capture of a lot of the largest purveyors of information through legacy media. So if there were to be some kind of association, you know, between these different, you know, groups, you know, consulting groups that are encouraging certain types of actions to pad their bottom lines and their perhaps associated funds, then naturally, if they're themselves also large stockholders in something like Discovery or Fox News or whatever it might be, we might be able to see how there could be a conflict of interest in the way that some of these common interest stories or financial reporting, you know, how some of this might actually end up making its way to the public eye.
And that's the thing is that as soon as you start to outline it and you talk about these conflicts of interest, people are like, oh, that sounds like a conspiracy. And it's like, you know, this big
definition.
Yeah.
But that's like, that shouldn't be a slur, right? It's just a way of thinking. It's a critical, skeptical way of thinking about the organization of capital.
And it's either true or it's not. But when you look at like the fact that the same consultant groups are in every single board and have insider information for every single company, which is illegal, right? Then it's like you can see it's not hard to see how the corruption happens. And you have because it's like end to end, they control the financial system, right? From in the banks have Boston Consulting Group, the boards of the companies that the public companies have Boston Consulting Group, and then the regulators have Boston Consulting Group, right? And they're all revolving doors to each other, right? You go from one to the other depending on your specialty. And you know, for me, it got so easy to see this, what their tactic was, is that just to look at where there was someone who was like Boston Consulting Group or McKinsey, and you just start to see the same, just the same playbook of this kind of mafia bust out, unfold. And I hope that more people can see the importance of it. And, I think we will.
I think one of the most critical things that you touched on there, over the course of the conversation so far, was how shareholder democracy is impacted by these broad groups. Because it's not only that, you know, a board will vote, you know, on how something might go internally, and maybe we never see exactly how that transpires. But you know, if a majority of a board has some given interest, then you know, presumably the board may act in that way. You know, assuming it can be arguably, you know, in fiduciary interest, etc. But then, of course, there's all the shareholders who should have their own democratic say, but when you are holding through, as you'd mentioned, you know, some kind of a retirement vehicle or other investment vehicle like a 401k, or even if you're holding in your broker, you're either foregoing that voting ability and your custodian is taking care of it, which can happen, or you're voting through a proxy and that proxy can, you know, may be cast, but may not necessarily in a one-to-one way get passed on to the company, to the transfer agent, to the vote tabulator, and these different entities that are trying to have an accurate democratic understanding of the shareholder interest. And I'd be happy to dive more into that. I think that's so important for folks to understand, but I would just want to wrap that around by saying again that, you know, direct registration, or more specifically, you know, having control custody of your investment, of your asset, that's the way that you can make sure to participate. And what's really unfortunate today is that, you know, the vast majority of companies, with a very small handful of exceptions, are 99.9% owned by this single custodial entity, CD & Co., which, you know, for listeners, we've done several episodes about that structure. So I definitely encourage, you know, rather than a deep dive right now, to go check those out. Probably folks are familiar a bit with it already. But point being, one thing that always cracks me up is if I think about, you know, fiduciary responsibility to, you know, to the owner, and the owner is this central custodian, and everyone else is a, you know, a beneficial owner, who might be holding through their broker, who might not be able to get their vote heard, who might not be able to review company documents or submit proposals for change or improvement. It's just really quite unfortunate, I think, that so many people are, you know, getting so involved in the market, and getting wanting to see things improve, not just for themselves, but for, you know, all investors, right? Or for the companies that they are passionate about. But there's still this brick wall of an intermediary where, you know, your broker has their own interests. The, you know, your Fidelities and your Robin Hoods and your Charles Schwab's and your IBKR's all, of course, operate for profit as well and have their own pockets to pad and their own bread to put on the table. It's just that their table's a lot bigger. They want a lot more bread. They're not as concerned about you getting it at the end of the day.
Yeah. And, you know, you follow the money, you follow that bread, and you can see where it goes. And, you know, one thing about, you know, I guess DRS is ownership. And part of that is ownership of the votes. And so when they have the power to basically create votes out of thin air or use, you know, these other passive investors through 401ks, votes, then they can, they channel that money. And part of this kind of corruption cycle is, you look at like Bed Bath & Beyond, for instance, and Mark Triton gave tons of money to these really progressive nonprofits, right? And then so then to see that people from those nonprofits, obviously they have a vested interest in keeping that cycle going so that they can keep that money flow going. And it ends up being this self-fulfilling prophecy where they're all married together. And so you have to break it somewhere because it's not in the best interest of the shareholders, right? It's fine for a person to have something they would like to do, right? But a public company it's supposed to be economic, right? And we've kind of just seen this takeover of our public markets to use that public money for these private things. And, you know, that value is taken from the shareholders. And, you know, we're both taught not to watch for it, but also like our vote, even if we are watching for it, doesn't matter. And that's something I'm excited to change.
Absolutely. That kind of, you know, again, I think back to the idea of curiosity and wanting to incite the change in the things that people are passionate about. And I love seeing, I think it's happening more and more. You know, we look online, of course, there's large communities like, I think of GameStop or BBBY or Tesla, you know, and they have meaningful online communities that are, you know, talking about their given investment, which is a great thing. And one thing that I think is so important for those communities to do, I mean, first is to be critical and to, you know, talk about ways that things could improve or if there is a potential, you know, foul play or things that don't quite make sense. I know that you've highlighted a few items from the BBBY, you know, leading into their Chapter 11 that maybe did not quite make sense, especially in the timeline. And I think that's terrific. You know, it's important for folks that, you know, that are exposing themselves to some kind of investment that they are paying very close attention to it and that they are interested in seeing it improve. Now, of course, not every investor has the interest or energy for that, and that's okay. You know, something like investing in the S&P directly, like with an ETF, et cetera. I mean, maybe that's better if you're in that kind of investor, but if you want to have a more direct impact with, you know, one company or with a handful of companies and see them improve and expect more accountability from them, that's where you start talking about the need for more active involvement, developing a community, you know, seeking custodial access to your assets so you can really weigh in, you know, go view the stock list, et cetera, all these incredible things that are possible, but only if you actually take advantage of these resources, which have been around for decades, but very few people still today, which, you know, no fault of their own. But of course, a broker is not going to explain to you how to take custody of the asset because you maintaining that relationship as a client with them, that's their bottom line. They need that. You know, they're taking advantage of that. They're using the data, using the trade data. You know, they're not making money on the trades anymore since our transition to free at the point of surface trading that Robinhood kind of pioneered, right? So naturally, they're not going to let us know, which means we have to let each other know about these options.
Yeah. And something I was just thinking of is a DRS, the one, like with GameStop, it got popularized. And one of the thoughts was that if the regular shareholders like you and me buy up all the shares, then they'll have to admit that there are counterfeit shares out there and there will be, you know, a short squeeze. And though that specific part of it hasn't happened yet, one victory that's quite substantial is the fact that they don't have the ability to mess with the voting. And it's interesting how far this goes up in politics. And the comptroller of New York was trying to use their votes to demand that people like, you know, Ryan Cohen or Larry Chang get kicked off the board because they need to make it more diverse, right? And so we got to see that at GameStop, the shareholders were like, no, we want who we want on there. It doesn't matter what their gender is. And, you know, that's a huge victory, because otherwise you can bypass the will of the actual shareholders through these other mechanisms. And it's really cool that there is a company that is owned by its shareholders. And right now I think that the only one that's in that situation is GameStop.
Yes. At the moment, at last reported, GameStop is owned about 18% by direct registered shareholders that have a complete and total assurance that, you know, each share they cast is going to be one vote that's counted in the manner in which they cast it. And that's absolutely unique. I mean, there's no regulatory expectation for companies to disclose any kind of information about the distribution of ownership on their internally tracked, you know, with the help of their transfer agent share ledger. And at the moment, the only companies that release any kind of detailed information are GameStop and AMC. AMC is, I think, in the vicinity of 0.2% DRS off the top of my head. So that's the second place slot right now, which is quite a bit lower, of course. And, you know, either way, it's incredible to think. I mean, you had alluded, right, that there's of course plenty of theories that are very popular in these different communities. And the reason I say theory is just because the information is asynchronous, right? I mean, there's a lot of smoke, but in this case, without legal force disclosure, we're not going to know there's a fire until things are on fire, in the case of ideas like MOAS, et cetera. But if there are many, many more shares floating around in the market than were issued by the company, which is very possible because there's multiple sanctioned legal ways for that to happen, then not only, as you pointed out, you know, would potentially having a high enough or 100% directly represented, you know, ownership, that would definitely raise some eyebrows. So all of these other shares that are being traded in the market are clearly entitlements with nothing backing them, and that would cause potentially some panic. But I think as you're pointing out, and just to really drive home here, the way that that'll work on the voting side is that, you know, if there are all these extra shares floating around, however it is that people submit their proxy votes to those brokers, the broker, if it has, you know, it's only supposed to have 1,000 shares, but it has 10,000 entitlements handed out to its clients, they're still only sending 1,000 votes when it comes time for the tabulator to collect them. And unfortunately, there's very little legal regulatory guideline about how they submit those votes, about which votes they submit. Maybe the broker has a specific dog in the race. We don't know that. And it's not publicized to us, and even worse, it's not publicized to the issuing company that's gathering that vote information. They don't get any of the information about, you know, how any of the bulk CD and co held assets vote. And so, you know, they're in the dark, we're in the dark, and ultimately it's just this interconnected series of member brokers within the central custody system that understand exactly what is happening. And that is deeply problematic, just in many different ways.
and I think that it's problematic on purpose. It's broken by design. It shouldn't be there shouldn't have to be a separate process, you know, to directly register your shares. Like that just, it shouldn't need to happen. Like this, you know, it's 2024, almost 2025, right? Like we have the technology easily to track it all. But the thing is that they want these loopholes. They want that room to be able to fudge numbers. And you can just see the process they go to prevent people from doing it. And I don't know if they you know, it's a matter of paying people like in the FTC to like stop mergers from happening, or, you know, or allowing things like market makers to, you know, be taking the money when maybe just the transfer agents should just be making the difference between those trades. If, you know, the market makers aren't actually doing trades because they're just, you know, moving around IOUs, well, maybe that the money that the market makers are making when between the bid and the ask difference, that maybe that should just go to the transfer agent. That way you could actually have shares be tracked.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, to get on to a tangent, not only do I think you're absolutely right. I mean, clearly these inefficiencies are built in on purpose, because by creating a complicated system and then introducing, you know, solutions to those problems, which are essentially, you know, moving money around in a complicated way, but you're not really making anything meaningful happen. We look back 50 years ago and self-custody was the norm. There was a paperwork crisis on Wall Street from everyone having to shuffle around these certificates, sign them and re-sign them to each other. But at least ownership was in the name of the individual, the much larger percentage of the time. And it was more transparent in that way. But, you know, due to that glut of paperwork in the pre-internet era, in the pre-computing era, you know, that this central depository system was, you know, argued for and ultimately implemented. And, you know, maybe at that time the arguments made sense, but we're living in a completely different world today. The advent of technologies such as blockchain, which allow for, you know, a public, auditable, interactable, transparent, and, you know, self-custody minded framework, means that there's really no need for this massive central depository. If you're after something like liquidity, you know, that's a big reason that they implemented it in the first place. But there are blockchains today that, such as, you know, there's one Stellar that has it was one of the first, online, you know, they call it SDEX. Essentially, it's like an order book, and people can trade their assets across it. And in much the way that you'd expect, you essentially have access to this market of liquidity, but you're not needing to deal with this custodial system. You can keep the custody of your assets in the way that you'd like to. And there are transfer agents which are trying to engage in that new technology. In fact, one of the most prolific contributors to RYDRS effort is the founder of one. His name's John Wooten, and he has a SEC-approved transfer agent that's operating today that uses that blockchain to track the issuer ledger and allows for a best-of-both-worlds scenario where investors that are, you know, invested in companies that use that blockchain, transfer agent, you know, they would, in theory, be able to access the liquid market and buy and sell in the way that you might expect, but without ever engaging with the legacy brokerage system. It's still something that is being built, but the patents are there. The technology is there. The trouble here is that it's just a massive infrastructure that exists that has been built up over the last 50 years, you know, essentially a monopolistic conglomerate of the largest financial markets in the world, which of course is not necessarily interested in making it easy for alternatives to get their footing.
Yeah. And I, as you were saying that, I was thinking about, you know, an actual order book, and that there is some need to, because if the order book isn't very full, then there can be a lot of movement in the price, or a big spread in the price. And if someone's just, you know, quickly hitting, you know, buy at the ask, like it could jump, you know, huge amounts, and people could get duped. But I think that that's also part of the, it's evident of, it's indicative of what the problem is. And it's that our markets have become so much based on speculation. That's like, what is the purpose of the market? Is it just a casino where you speculate? Or is it a part where you buy ownership into a company? And I just think that because like people just assume like they don't even care if their vote works, or like most people, very few people even vote with their shares, right? Because most people just have some kind of 401k or whatever. They don't know what they own. And that means that someone else owns it. And then the question is, well, what does the real owner want to do with it? And it's like, well, we can see what they want to do with it. You know, they cannibalize, you know, companies one at a time. They have their darling and they pump it up, and they pump it up using what they got from, you know, shorting some other company into the ground. And so I just really think that along with this ownership movement, like, it should mean something to have this ownership. There should be some sort of incentive to be invested in what you hold. And as crazy as this is, I do think about, and, you know, would love to, you know, hear other people's thoughts, you know, it doesn't have to be right now, but just that I think that if companies were required to give a dividend, that would make all the difference, because even if that dividend was like 1 cent per quarter, it would still at least be a projection of what a company can do. And so you would see, like, the board said they could do 1 cent, you know, they weren't able to give it. And then there can be accountability that happens. The shareholders could be like, you didn't meet your expectations, right? Or, you know, they promise 1 cent and they end up giving 5 cents of a dividend. And then it's like, okay, yeah, like we see the results, right? We like where this is headed. So I just think that there's ways to make it less about speculation. Maybe there could be a whole different market of smaller companies that you speculate on that aren't big enough to actually offer a dividend. But if that was the case, if you knew, you could clearly, everyone could easily just see the history of the dividends and the history of whether they met that dividend or beat it, then it could just be kind of a calculation on whether or not that's worth it. And there wouldn't be as much volatility, and everyone could just manage their own. It's like, hey, what company, you know, seems to have a good track record, or, you know, or what company do you think is not going to disappear anytime soon? And we just have all these middlemen, like in all these jobs that shouldn't exist, right? You know, we shouldn't need a market maker. Like you were saying, there's companies, Stellar, there's other ones, you know, Loopring, T0. There's tons of these market automated order book, you know, technologies that could just be implemented. And then you could just get rid of all these market makers who are just scooping the cream off the top and, you know, leaving everyone, you know, high and dry. So I see the technology is there. I think the only thing that needs to be there is the awareness of how important it is that we start implementing that technology.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that the awareness is so key, not only of the importance of implementing it, but, you know, understanding how it solves the problem, you know, which I guess ends up being, you know, there's always more complication, because then as you're talking about, I need to understand what the problem is and how the solution acts in counterbalance to the established hierarchy of how these markets and how liquidity operates in these markets today. And I think the idea of incentivizing direct registration is a really interesting one. You know, certainly a dividend, you know, that's something that would get sent out to all shareholders, be they direct registered or not. And you're not allowed to distribute a dividend to only a subset of your shareholders. It always needs to be something which is distributed equally in the U.S. But one thing that is interesting is that there is a pattern. This is something that happens a lot internationally, and I've not been able to find any evidence that it'd be not able to organize in the U.S. But in other markets, and for example, in Europe, France, Germany, some Japanese countries, some Australian companies, they have bonuses for direct registered shareholders. Things like, you know, you'll get maybe 5% off your online orders just flat if you have direct registered shares, or you'll get first access to like new products or test products, things like this. They take advantage of the idea that they have a direct communique with those shareholders and use that to inform the way that they choose to advance their products or grow into new areas. Because one thing that's crucial to remember, you know, if you're holding through a broker, which is ultimately through CD & Co., the company has no idea who you are. There's a pseudo anonymity that goes on there where they don't know who your name, your holding amount. They don't know where you live, anything like that. But if you are holding directly on their books in your own name, then they do know, you know, your name, your address, your information. And, you know, they could send out, you know, missives or mailers or surveys to try to take advantage of that kind of thing. That's going beyond, you know, other types of advocacy help that direct registration provides, things like submitting proposals for vote or, submitting board nominations, which are things that direct registered shareholders can do if they meet certain thresholds. So, but that doesn't really motivate everyone. Some people are not necessarily interested in, specifically learning about their one company and helping it grow in some super specific way. They just want a better return. And in that kind of sense, maybe they'd be more interested if there were a more tangible benefit, like a dividend, yes, or also like like helping that company develop better products or getting coupons, things like that, which are only distributed or available to this kind of shareholder, which again is a common international practice. And I've scoured. I don't see what the issue would be if a U.S. based company decided to do something like that. But I'm also not aware of any U.S. based companies that do. So it's an interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah, and we could, I like that because you could get away from even like the membership thing of like a Costco or a Sam's Club membership. It's like, okay, well, you have a legitimate GameStop Pro membership because you hold a certain amount of shares. And so you get that discount because you're, part owner in the company. I mean, the shareholders are the owners. And I think that those, and it wouldn't have to be necessarily a mailer or anything. I mean, there should be a way, my hope is that there's some kind of brokerage that goes through the X app, which would be awesome. And it seems like that might be on its way, where there could be more of a free kind of communication for companies to their shareholders. You know, my idea of the dividend was, mostly just to, because I feel like right now there's only three types of, investors. There's the completely passive investors where they've completely given the keys to their investment to someone else and it's just in some random, mutual fund or whatever. And then there's swing traders and day traders. And there's really, the idea of like, deep value or value investing where it's like, I see this company and I plan on investing in it. Someone like Richard Newton, right? He's like, I like this company. I like where it's going. And, I want to support this company. Right. And, I think that by taking out so much of the speculative nature of the market, then there would just be more incentive to find companies that you really like, to know which ones are consistently performing well instead of just like hoping that some weird glitch in the market, I mean, so much of what people research right now is about, just volume tracking, for momentum trading, and just looking at TA to, technical analysis to see what the algorithms might be doing, how they might be pumping stuff. And it's like, that's so lame, right? Because you can't be confident in what it's going to do, right? Like, you look at like, SMCI, right? Like Super Microcomputers, right? Like they just said that their CFO left because of they don't want to actually be the criminal that actually puts down their numbers, right? And then it's like they hire some other corrupt, accounting firm allegedly, that they're willing to put down the numbers despite the consequences, and somehow that makes the company run, you know, 33% in a day. It's like that's the kind of speculation that it's just like, there's a lot of money that trades hands when that happens. And there are insiders that know what's going to happen because of that. And I really think that there could be a lot more transparency and a lot less middlemen between the company and the shareholders. And it's just a huge win-win for everyone.
Yeah, well, I certainly couldn't agree with that last bit more, that more transparency between a company and its shareholders can only benefit both. I think that's so crucial. And I would say, there's another type of investor beyond the ones you laid out, which is, you know, the long-term investor who, I mean, maybe that's someone who's checked out and beyond the ones that are just in a 401k, but, you know, the ones that are seeking the self-custody and who are really trying to actively engage, or at least, you know, follow directly, you know, the news and information being put out by the company that they invest with. I think this is becoming, you know, this is a type of investor whose share of the retail market, as it were, you know, the amount of folks like this has certainly shrunk. I know a lot of people, and I've met a lot of people in their 60s, 70s, 80s who grew up investing in a certain way, you know, having stock certificates in their safe at their house, following along and in the, you know, with the news from, you know, whatever the earnings reports that are getting put out, you know, and really carefully appraising these different things. But that had definitely fallen out of style in a big way. People transitioning towards, you know, a more diverse exposure that limits volatility, but also, you know, makes it less likely that you're going to be able to meaningfully understand exactly what the impacts might be of, you know, real world events on market value, if there even is a direct correlation there. And part of this DRS movement that has kind of grown out of the stock, the buy button turn off in 2021 and all this incredible online community growth, I think is in some ways it's a hearkening back to those really active investing mentalities where people are, you know, paying close attention to every individual 8K, every individual quarterly report, every prospectus of the companies that they're invested with. I think the same thing is true, you know, in a slightly different way, but for the BBBY community that is still following along with every new docket and trying to understand the process, you know, because they have a meaningful and tangible connection in terms of, you know, their passion and their asset relationship, you know, with this entity. And that's a really terrific thing that I would love to encourage. And that's definitely part of the ethos behind what we're working on. It's just trying to make it easier for folks to understand how to get that kind of connection. Because one thing that I am a bit less enthusiastic about is the idea of any kind of third party that is trying to create that kind of connection on behalf of the company and on behalf of the investor. I think of, you know, there's a couple different online services that have cropped up over the last couple of years. I'm not going to list any off, but ones where, you know, they try to get you to pair your brokerage account and they, you know, develop a online identity for you to then communicate out to that company. And there can be some public aggregation of data in that way. But what I think what's unfortunate about it is that it's centralized in a different way by a different intermediary. And what I'd really love to see is direct, meaningful communication between investors and the companies themselves. And to hell with all these intermediaries that want to make money off of fostering that communication when we have the tools to make it happen already today and without involving them.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it's all about incentives, you know, where like is there an incentive for, you know, like ComputerShare or whatever the other one is, like to AST to start implementing these things? Because I think that the reason there aren't as many investors in that fourth class where, like you'd mentioned, that hold long term is because the incentives are, you know, aren't as immediate, right? Like it's, you can't sell covered calls, right? I mean, that's, so it's like I think it's by design that it's like they either want to be able to abuse your shares while you're not direct registered, you know, lend them out, all these other things. And, or like they'll, like they make it to where you can't either have as much liquidity to sell or to sell covered calls, especially through these other kind of systems. And I just think that it's like, it's in everyone's best interest for literally the whole model of how the public markets work to make the market, make people want to invest, right? Like the more money we put in, the more we can potentially do. And so my whole point was that of that the culture, the incentive and the culture around buying and holding and direct registering your shares is a hard one. And I think it will in the case of GameStop pay off very soon. But you think like having to move to get 3 days to move out of your DRS, right? And, you know, a lot of the big runs that we saw in GameStop, you know, they only lasted a certain amount of time. And, you know, I just, it's just such a shame in my opinion that, that so much of the movement and the value that's extracted from this whole process is just out of pure speculation and nothing of like actual tangible value.
Yeah, that is the saddest takeaway. Absolutely. That is what so much of these different intermediaries are doing, you know, just gambling amongst themselves. And it has so little to actually do with the underlying asset, the people who might believe in that asset or who are rooting against that asset either way. All of the actual real day-to-day workers that are, you know, tangibly, you know, connecting their existence and reality to earning, working for whatever that company is, you know, and it's just all of them, set aside in preference and deference to this, the kind of gambling hierarchy that is going on under the surface. And, you know, when you hear something like Chairman Gensler on Bloomberg News last year saying that 95% plus of retail orders are going to different dark pools across the whole of the market, it's like, how have we got to this point? Because it did not happen overnight. And that is just crazy. It is really disgusting that the people have no real ability to actually meaningfully directly interact with what's going on. And what's unfortunate, right, is that I think you're really astute in drawing on this problem of incentives, because although we could theorize about this this future market where you know, custody is the norm, transparent asset tracking on blockchain is the norm, but getting from A to B is very difficult when, in the short term, if you decide to embrace this idea of self-custody and this idea of long-term asset management and, you know, delayed gratification, you know, it's like Squidward looking out the window, and these guys are selling, you know, being able to take advantage of their margin. And, you know, maybe you're seeing on your social media feed the ones where it's working out a lot more than the ones where it isn't. And it's like, well, what am I getting out of this? You know, yeah, okay, my vote is being counted every year, but if the company is growing a lot less and I don't have that much passive income, you know, and times are difficult, then how do we cross that gap? And I think that is an open question. It's certainly one that I don't have any great answer for at the moment. I just want to stress that there are benefits, and it's of each type of holding, and it's up to the individual to decide, of course, in their specific circumstance, what makes sense in the broader context for them. Because the system that we're in, that all of us are in, that we didn't have any say in, you know, that's the only one we've got meaningfully at this moment.
I think that's true. I mean, we are faced with that sort of dichotomy. Do we DRS at the expense that it costs, or do we join the corrupt speculative market? And I think that, like, another, while we make that choice, part of it is that maybe we can open it up to more choices by actually just making a difference, right? I think that's kind of one thing is we've been kind of groomed to be just consumers, that we just consume whatever we like. Our whole identity is in our preferences, you know, is wrapped up in our preferences. And it's like, oh, well, I choose A or B. And we don't really think like, wait, who is it that's making this the only choice between A and B? And, you know, that we should either A, like be looking for, you know, who else is out there producing another option, right? Or, you know, is it worth it? Should we actually just try and do it ourselves? Because, you know, at some point we have to just see the value is there, and it's just a matter of making it happen. And I think that, you know, building, we've been building communities and, you know, bringing awareness, and, you know, at some point the rubber has to meet the road, and, you know, we have to build a roadmap to say like, what would it take? I mean, for me, like, you know, I don't know in depth, I don't know who really runs, you know, what the intentions of T0 are or Loop Ring. I don't know, but I do know that it's worth figuring out, and I've been trying to figure it out because, you know, I see people trying to make an option that's different than just either DRSing at computer share or AST and, you know, being part of this, corrupt market. And, you know, I think it might take, you know, I mean, who knows, like either starting our own business or lobbying, you know, government officials or just holding them accountable. I know, you know, I talked to, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's easier to get engaged than we think, right? There was a recent lawsuit against BlackRock for them abusing their proxy votes for different kind of ESG related things. And, you know, I don't know if I had an effect on that, but the person that did the lawsuit, you know, I had just talked to him, you know, a few weeks before that and told them that that was a problem. And, you know, that's their job, you know, they're a public servant, and, you know, that they actually did it. So, I mean, if we don't ask, we don't know, what they're actually going to do. And so that was pretty encouraging. And I think we've also been taught, along with being consumers, is to not have initiative, to be scared of making mistakes and whatnot. And I don't know. I mean, it's just, you miss all the shots you don't take. And so, you know, reaching out, I mean, if, you know, you got to figure out one, what's the roadmap. And there's lots of people that have been exploring that. I see 100 MPH down there. He's a good resource. I mean, there's lots of good resources that have been trying to see what effectuates change, because I think that what the people in power want is for us to scream into a pillow and feel like we got out our rage, and then that's just, it's just done, right? Like, there's even like, there's a whole movement in the 60s and 70s about just, you know, where you just break things or punch a wall or whatever, and you just let it out, they would say, right? That's one, at a psychological level, that's total horse crap. That's not how it works. you know, that emotion is saying that you need to center yourself, not that you need to lose control of yourself. So you have to think, like, are the people that are espousing that kind of idea that you can just go and, you know, I think the famous one is getting like a tennis racket and hitting a bed or whatever. You can see videos of people doing that. And they still, those types of, you can even go to retreats right now and do that kind of crap, which is crazy. But it's because we've been groomed to lash out in ineffective ways that we feel vindicated after we just broke something, even if it's something we own or someone, you know, we live with owns, and not something that actually affects the person who's actually damaging us. You know, we're more than consumers, and we can effectuate real change. It might not get immediate feedback. No one might even watch us while we do it. No one might even care. We might even have people that try to discourage us from doing it. You know, I had, you know, two people already just come into the space and try and distract me. And, you know, it's sad, right? That those sort of tactics work. And we're in this world, and it's only going to get worse, where knowing who's real, who's not, who is paid to spin certain narratives and whatnot. Because most people just, they're either A, too busy working hard, or B, don't think they can make any change or don't want to even try. And so it's the 1-5% of people that are really changing everything. And if, you know, it's a quantifiable amount of money that it would take to steer or deter the people that would make a difference. It's pretty easy to see them. C.S. Lewis has a book called The Screwtape Letters. It's definitely my favorite book. Highly recommend it. And there was an addition put on it that he made, which is called Screwtape Proposes a Toast. And he says that one dictator asked another dictator how he keeps his people in line. And the dictator took him out to a field of wheat and ran his cane above the top and knocked off all the top stalks. And he said the message was clear, that if anyone kind of rises above and tries, you know, then you just knock them down immediately and you stop that momentum. And so there are definitely people out there, the media, even people that for some reason, you know, their full-time job is to infiltrate communities like this one to stop momentum that will lead to real change. And I would just say that, you know, it has to be something deep within you that's like, I'm going to fix this no matter if anyone cares or not. Right. You know, that meeting that ended up leading to that lawsuit against BlackRock, you know, we had, you know, the other person that was with me, we had tons of people like pounce on us with all these excuses on why that was going to mess up everything. It was the most bizarre thing. And I'm like, huh, like, why do they not want us to make real change? I mean, it's an obvious good thing. And, you know, now in hindsight, it's like, oh, okay. You know, you follow the money and it's pretty obvious why they're doing what they're doing is maybe that BlackRock using that money for those specific kind of ESG sort of agendas is trickling down to them, right? And, you know, not that I'm against any sort of, you know, I think there should be progress in an ethical way in the world. And I'm not just some kind of pure capitalist. But just as there needs to be a separation of church and state, there needs to be a separation of politics and, you know, right now the people that are controlling it, they have a specific agenda, and it's one that leads people to be, you know, it's not one based on competence. And that's something the government should worry about, not the financial system. And I think that's changing, and that's something I'm also excited about.
I definitely am as well. I really appreciate the message here is that, you know, to become as someone who's activated in, you know, the whatever spaces that are important to you, it's a power that comes from within. And if it does, if you're able to manifest it, then people can't take that away from you either. They may try. Certainly there's a lot of vitriol in online spaces, but ultimately if something is important to you and you want to get involved with it, then there are going to be avenues to do so. Whether or not you find one of a diverse range of potential efforts which might already exist, or if you start your own, you know, there is, it's an incredible thing, right? Where I think the internet and the social media ecosystem, not only does it, as you elucidated, you know, it gives us more access than we might have otherwise to some negative energies, to people that are putting down whatever it is that we might be expressing as an important value. But at the same time, it gives you so much more ability to connect with not only like minds that might share those same passions, but to connect with, you know, power players like elected officials that may have a real say, or to help to organize with things like this incredible BlackRock lawsuit that I admittedly need to read more about that. So I'll be checking that out after our conversation concludes. Or things like submitting group petitions to regulators or otherwise. For example, you know, YDRS had helped to organize through the SEC petitions process, a amendment to the NSCC policies, which essentially allow for them to hand wave liabilities in excess of, to any liabilities that might, in their estimation, cause market turmoil. At the moment, they can just say, well, we don't want to worry about that one. We're just going to, we're not obligated to close out that liability. And, I don't think that's quite fair. If they are, if they, through their negligence and malfeasance, have created some kind of problem, then the people who are on the long side of that should be made whole, whatever the situation is, not being able to hand wave that. There's tons of ways to get involved. And I guess I'll take this opportunity quickly just to mention, for anyone listening, we've got plenty of names I don't recognize today, which is great. YDRS is an effort that, started by several people about a year and a half ago now. Not only are we the first to file in America this new legal entity structure called a DUNA, which is a decentralized unincorporated nonprofit association, meaning that we're an educational resource which is built by an online collaborative effort. There's no central nominated leadership. Things are discussed online. We have all of our code base on GitHub and all of our resources freely available. We're also currently going through the process of being approved as a charitable 501c3 nonprofit with the IRS, pending maybe approval sometime early in this coming year. So if you're interested at all in participating with that, then, just by simply wanting to participate, you're more than welcome to be a member of that DUNA and to stop by any of our online resources and leave your ideas and comments to help us grow. Because this information has been difficult to parse for decades now. And it's important for folks to know how they can get activated and how they can get involved and make it easier for more people to do the same. So if this particular issue happens to be the one that is speaking to you, then we'd love to hear more from you.
Love that. Also, just to kind of clarify, for me, even though, who I would vote for isn't someone who's progressive. I mean, in part, that's just because I don't like any of the progressives that are out there. I mean, a few that I would like seem to switch sides to the coalition kind of government. But, the thing is that I think that moving away from all these passive investors towards everyone just owning shares of actual companies would lead to it being better for both sides, right? Even though, the people on the left right now are supporting these big corporations. I mean, one, it's kind of ironic because those big corporations are turning the left against what they originally stood for, which is super ironic. But, it shouldn't be like a winner takes all. And right now the winner is determined by BlackRock and Vanguard, which are essentially just one company. And so we're in this system where one ideology, which might not match up with any single individual, is somehow in control of all of the public companies. And so if you got rid of all these mutual funds and all these, other, things, then it would be the actual shareholders. And that'd be totally fine if there was, some really progressive, if even though I think like something like The Onion or Everytown, right, which are trying to anyway pulling a stunt right now, and I think they're incredibly corrupt, but if they were just a public company, right, then people that actually like that could invest in them, and there'd also be more transparency, which I think is really important, because that's the thing. I remember I watched an interview just yesterday of Everytown, and they're talking about this bid for that was fraudulent for I just blanked on what the name of the Alex Jones's show. And the thing is that they were saying it's probably surprising to see us working together, but we actually have a lot in common. It's like, well, of course you do, right? But that's the thing is that we have such a lack of transparency that it's like, I think that the same thing that there should be a transparency as far as like a company's financials. Well, it would just be a lot easier if you knew who was investing in which company, and you could actually tell what their incentives were. And that can't happen right now because BlackRock and Vanguard just own everyone. So I think that it would be just to separate the two, then people could see, you know, one, what actually works for a company, right? Like, see the ones that are very progressive and see how they move forward, right? See the ones that are very conservative, see how they move forward, and let the proof be in the pudding rather than forcing everyone to use one equation, one formula, and then we just get crashes, market crashes every every so many years. So I think the direct ownership, you know, the public, the shareholders being the owners of the company, like I just, you know, like I just think of like Doug Cifu when he's like he his lawyer sent me a letter to a cease and desist letter to not keep talking about him and different things about that I think are corrupt. And, you know, the lawyer said, referred to Virtu as Doug Cifu's company, right? And it's like these executives, and in other interviews, I've seen, you know, Doug Cifu kind of allude to the fact that he, it's his company and he runs it the way he wants. And that's just not the case. It's a company by the shareholders. And, you know, just because he has connections to BlackRock and all those other companies and has access to all the votes in his company doesn't mean he owns the company. And that shouldn't be the case. So I just think this can help out everyone. Just everyone has to realize that it would be a win-win.
You know, certainly I'm right there with you that transparency and efficiency, you know, just seeking for more honesty also in the way that these markets operate, in the way that companies, you know, public or private, how they operate within this broader ecosystem, it'd be better if we could understand on a real incentive level, you know, why they might operate the way that they operate. And to say nothing of any individual or group's political leanings, I think broadly, many folks would agree that this kind of transparency would be helpful, just so that we can put, you know, better understand the world around us here. I mean, we're trying to navigate a complicated environment of information, and it's made only more difficult by these different associations, incentives, you know, be they monetary or personal or otherwise. And, you know, all of that is one other great reason why additional disclosures and a move towards direct registration in the case of public companies would be so helpful. I mean, certainly, like I've said, at the moment, there's no regulatory expectation for companies to go into any public detail about their distribution of, you know, types of shareholder on their issuer ledger, be they, you know, 99% CD and co owned or 82% or whatever it might be. But companies can choose to release this information if they want to. Most just don't. I did have the opportunity last year to interview Chairman Gensler at the SEC, and he did clarify that there is no rule against companies releasing this information. They just need to choose to do it. And, you know, when prompted, well, why don't more companies do it then? At that time, only two companies were doing it, and still today, only two companies do it. And so he said, well, it's because they must not think that it's materially important to their investor base, which is an interesting answer, right? Because if the majority of their investor base is technically CD and Co, I mean, one could understand probably why CD and Co is not trying to make, you know, not trying to scream this consolidation from the rooftops. So as I think as more people get involved in this custodial framework and make it clear to the companies, that this is important to them. Eventually, right, even if you have a board of folks that don't want to publicize this information, there is a tipping point somewhere where you need to start releasing what your shareholders are asking for. And that is going to create a much more transparent investing environment where folks are going to realize, oh, well, this company is completely beholden to the establishment custodial structure. And this other company, or this other set of companies, perhaps are not. And maybe that's going to be important to certain types of investors to evaluate their investment decisions, when unfortunately right now there's just no meaningful way to get that kind of information to the public, which is a damn shame.
Well, we have a lot of work ahead of us, that's for sure. But I'm encouraged to see how many competent people like you who seem to be genuinely good people that I found through this process. And I'm really excited to see what we can do.
Absolutely. Yeah, me too. And I really appreciate all your time today there, Michael. We've been going at it almost an hour and a half, and I wanted to check in with you, you know, first to see if there's anything else major you wanted to touch on, how much time you have, and then to mention that, you know, typically we'll kind of open it up, see if there's any listeners that have any questions or anything like that, if you've got the time for it. And if you're ready for that, maybe we could move to that section here.
Sure. Yeah, we can move to that if you want.
All right. Well, great. So with that, you know, anyone who is interested, you know, raise a hand or request a speaker role. If you have any questions about anything we've discussed, and, you know, we'll take the next couple minutes and see how all that goes. How much time do you have today, Michael?
I mean, I'm just chilling for right now. So, I mean,
oh, great. Makes it easy.
Yeah.
So we'll give folks a chance to muster up the courage to come up if they have anything they wanted to mention. And, you know, kind of in the interim, I wanted to ask you, you know, if you had the chance to have you thought much about or looked into much about the YDRS structure that I'd mentioned there, the DUNA, et cetera, because it's something which is an emergent structure. I was curious if you'd had any thoughts on it or need to do more digging still.
Yeah, I haven't looked into it yet. I mean, for me, it's just a lot of things have been changing rapidly. I mean, it's been a crazy, crazy last 2 years, you know, going from graduating med school to, you know, starting a business, selling a business, investing, you know, somehow becoming quite involved in politics. And
yeah, it's going on. I know.
Yeah, and then just like the Bed Bath and Beyond thing, you know, the final hearing was supposed to be all the way back in, I think it was July, actually, was the first time it was scheduled for like the last hearing. And then it got moved back a month, and it got moved to like August 2nd, got moved back again. And then it, like, I think of like, is it the third or the fourth time it got moved to, now it's finally on November 26th. And so I think we're good. I think what I think is going to play out is going to play out then. But man, it's been a long time to have my, you know, the bulk of my money locked up in this stock. And, it's been quite frustrating, that and just, I mean, all the rest of the manipulation that goes around with it. I mean, the market maker exemption that the market makers have, where they can just not deliver a share for 35 days and they can literally just pass the buck to someone else. Like I got to find, the post I did, but I started looking into each bank and their holdings. If you just type in like a name of a bank, like TD Bank, and then just holdings, and it will come up and it'll show you what their holdings are. And it's really weird, 'cause each one will just have like a spike for like one day, and it's like on a different day. And it's just like when FTX was collapsing and all reserves, and it was very obvious, because you'd see like all these, this flow of crypto from all the brokers to the one that was being audited, and then they would all go to the next broker, and it's like, you've got to be kidding me. So I think that the market makers have been doing the same thing. The market makers and the bank have been abusing this market maker exemption to just shift that bag around, and either shift it around every 35 days or every 2 days. But either way, you can clearly see that that's being passed around. And so you can't, you know, even if you're following a company, the day the news comes out might not be the day where that price, that true price discovery happens. And it's incredibly frustrating. So yeah, I've been busy with all that.
Yeah, I hear you completely. I wanted to welcome Poetically Informative up here. Hey, thanks so much for coming on up.
Oh, I'm glad you brought me up. I don't know if I'm ready to say anything at this point, because I came in late and I'm just trying to get the gist of what's going on, but I'm all in on the corruption that we see and want to do something about. You know, that's very important to me as well.
Well, okay. Welcome to the team.
Yeah, sure. Welcome. Absolutely. Well, every bit of every hands counts, every bit of effort counts, and spreading the word around, getting people more incited and more curious, so they can understand what's going on here.
And I think that's what you're doing here, and I think that's what is incumbent upon every single one of us to do. And you know, for you know, those that we're in touch with, you know, little by little, inform people as to what's really going on in the markets, which are supposed to be public and free and transparent to a degree, and they are not nearly as transparent as the public is led to believe. So I think, you know, we all have a part in exposing those who are very afraid to be exposed.
And I think one thing that you reminded me as you come up is you know, I've met you in person, and I think you're a great person. And you know, through this whole process, even though it's been really long, we've kind of seen, as I've been trying to work with people, like who out there is a genuine person, who out there is fighting the good fight. And the reason we're in this mess is there's a lot of these groups, you know, not just the consultants like Boston Consulting Group and whatnot, but like there's also specific, you know, fraternities, sororities that when you start connecting them together, you're like, oh, well, that's really weird. Like, Why is Kamala Harris and P. Diddy part of the same the same fraternity sorority group, right? Like that's kind of odd, right? And you know, then Obama is as well. Like, well, that's really weird. So it's like these groups get together and they end up having an influence. And the history of America is the history, well, the history of the world is of unions and fraternities and just how whole groups, you know, the power of the group is what usually matters. And so, you know, we can form a group based on alignment on real ideals rather than just the fact that we went to the same university or